Have you ever watched your own hands do something you specifically promised yourself you wouldn't do?
Absolutely, all the time.
Right. Like maybe you're opening a social media app for the 50th time today, or you're already mid-argument saying that exact sarcastic comment you swore you'd bite back.
Yeah, it feels terrible.
It's like your brain is running this pre-written script and you're just a passenger helplessly watching the scene play out.
We usually call that being on autopilot. But, you know, in the moments when life gets stressful or exhausting, that autopilot isn't just cruising along safely.
No, not at all.
Right. It is actively dragging you into habit loops and compulsions that rarely serve you. It's the feeling of being pulled by a current you just can't seem to swim against.
Which brings us to our mission for today's deep dive. We are figuring out how to stop being dragged around by those compulsive pulls and actually reclaim the wheel of your own mind.
And it is definitely possible.
To do this, we're unpacking a really comprehensive resource called the RAFT program. For a quick bit of context, RAFT is an acronym. It stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feel, and Train.
Exactly.
Today, we are zooming in on chapter 58 of the material, which sits right inside that final train stage. And it's all about this concept called skillful intention.
Yeah, and to put that in context, if you look at the step right before this in the framework, which is skillful perspective, that phase is really about understanding your landscape.
Like getting the lay of the land.
Right. It's reading the map, seeing the weather patterns of your life, acknowledging where you are, but knowing the weather doesn't actually keep your boat on course when a sudden storm hits, you know?
Yeah, a map won't steer the boat for you.
Exactly. So skillful intention is the action phase. It is the act of deliberately grabbing the rudder. It's the literal mechanics of making a choice when the pressure is on.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, intention is a word we toss around constantly.
We really do.
We talk about having good intentions, or like setting an intention for the day, which honestly usually just means a vague, fuzzy hope that things go well.
Right, like I hope I'm productive today.
Exactly. But the RAFT program treats intention as a very precise psychological tool, not just a feeling.
Yeah, and the text is actually really careful to carve away what intention is not, so we can see what it actually is.
What do you mean?
Well, first, it emphasizes that intention is not a mood.
Wait, really? Not a mood.
Right, because you don't really choose a mood, do you? It just sort of arrives based on whatever physiological or environmental conditions you're facing in that moment.
Oh, I see. Like you wake up, it's cloudy outside, maybe you didn't sleep well, and suddenly your brain is just broadcasting gloom.
Exactly. You didn't intend to be gloomy. It's just the weather system currently sitting over your brain.
Makes sense. So if it's not a mood, what else isn't it?
Intention is also not an impulse. An impulse is a current that actively pulls you toward a compulsion. It's that immediate hot flash of, like, I need this right now, or I must react instantly.
Oh, yeah, that really urgent feeling.
Right. And perhaps most importantly, an intention isn't just a wish. Wishing is entirely passive.
Oh, I'm definitely guilty of that.
We all are. It's just picturing a peaceful destination without ever picking up the oars to actually row there.
Okay, so we're completely ruling out moods, impulses, and passive wishes. So what is the actual definition we're working with here?
The program describes it as the quieter, steadier lean of the heart.
The lean of the heart. I like that.
Yeah, it's a direction we deliberately choose to nourish before our speech or our actions take shape.
So it happens before the behavior.
Exactly. We might not have control over every random chaotic thought that pops onto the deck of our mind, but we absolutely control which of those thoughts we rehearse, feed, and steer by.
That actually reminds me of an observation from Gautama the Buddha, which is cited in the RAFT program.
Oh, yes, that's a great quote.
He pointed out that whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will eventually become the inclination of their mind.
And what's fascinating is that ancient philosophical observation perfectly mirrors our modern understanding of neuroplasticity.
Because the brain physically changes based on what it rests upon, right?
Exactly. The neurons wire together based on repetition.
I always think of it like walking through a dense field of tall grass. The first time you walk a path, it's really difficult. You have to push the heavy grass aside.
Right, takes a lot of effort.
But if you walk that exact same path every single day, you trample the grass down into a clear, hard-packed dirt trail. Eventually, you don't even have to look where you're going. Your feet just follow the path of least resistance.
That is a perfect analogy.
So if you constantly replay resentment or anxiety in your head, you are trampling down a path for conflict. Your brain expects it, looks for it, defaults to it.
And it gets easier to get angry every time.
Exactly. But if you deliberately rehearse a different response, you are carving a completely new, smoother trail. So to you, the listener, why should you care about this distinction? Because right now, today, your recurring thoughts are actively paving the default settings your brain will use tomorrow.
And this brings us to the practical application of that idea. When those compulsive pulls try to drag you down the old destructive dirt paths, what alternative trails can you actually choose?
Right. What are the actual rudder settings?
Well, the RAFT program outlines three very specific directions we can lean toward. And it's crucial to understand that these aren't about shrinking your life or restricting yourself.
They're about hiding from the world.
Not at all. They're designed to free you up.
Yeah.
The first direction the text suggests is abandoning.
Okay. I have to be honest here. I really struggle with that word.
Really? Why is that?
Abandoning just sounds so bleak to me. It sounds like grim self-denial, where you just sit in an empty room, white-knuckling your way through life, forcing yourself to say no to everything pleasurable. How is that supposed to feel like freedom?
That is a very common reaction, actually. But the text makes a crucial distinction about the mechanism of abandoning. It isn't about punishing yourself or rejecting joy.
So what is it abandoning, then?
It's specifically meant to counteract the pull of craving. Craving is that agonizing, restless belief that if you just acquire one more thing, one more distraction, one more purchase, one more swipe, you will finally feel complete and okay.
Oh. So craving is a trap that kind of disguises itself as comfort.
Yes. Beautifully said. When you practice abandoning, you are turning a no to that compulsion into a massive yes to a life that is lighter and clearer.
You're just letting go of the heavy baggage that keeps dragging you under the water.
Exactly. If craving is an island that promises shelter but actually traps you, abandoning is simply steering the boat back out into the open water. You aren't abandoning happiness.
You're abandoning the trap.
Precisely.
Okay, dropping a heavy weight isn't self-denial. It's relief. I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
But what if the issue isn't craving? What if the compulsion pulling you is just pure, unadulterated frustration?
Right, when you're just furious.
Yeah, say a coworker throws you under the bus in a meeting, and your immediate impulse is to retaliate and burn the bridge. Abandoning doesn't quite fit the white hot heat of anger.
No, it doesn't. And that requires the second direction, which is goodwill.
Goodwill.
Yeah. Goodwill is the practice of friendliness to both yourself and others. It is the direct antidote to resentment, irritation, and ill will.
Because anger makes everything so tight, right?
It's literally. When ill will takes over, the mind tightens up. Your vision narrows. You want to blame, punish, or push away, which usually causes you to crash right into more conflict.
So how does goodwill help?
Cultivating goodwill cools that temperature down. It keeps your hands steady on the helm so you avoid unnecessary collisions caused by pure reactivity.
Let's look at the dark side of that, though.
Yeah.
Sometimes we aren't hot with anger. We're just completely frozen.
Yeah.
Apathy.
Right. We get so overwhelmed by the state of the world or the stress of our own lives that we fall into this callous numbness. We just stop caring altogether. How do you steer out of utter apathy? For that, the program offers harmlessness as the third direction.
Harmlessness?
Yes. Harmlessness is the active practice of compassion and non-cruelty. It directly counters aggression, but it also slices right through that careless numbness you're talking about.
How does it do that?
It asks a very simple grounding question. Does this choice reduce harm for me and for others?
Oh, wow. That really anchors you.
It does. It forces you to re-engage with the reality that your actions and your well-being actually matter.
So we have abandoning for craving, goodwill for anger, harmlessness for numbness. That makes total sense conceptually.
Conceptually, yes.
But here is the massive roadblock. It is incredibly easy to sit here right now listening to a deep dive and agree with all of this.
Oh, of course.
But when that coworker actually throws you under the bus, or when it's 10 p.m. and you're feeling lonely, logic goes straight out the window. The compulsion hits, and it feels like there's literally no other option but to react the way you always do. Mm-hmm. How do you remember these settings in the heat of the moment?
That feeling of inevitability is exactly what we have to target. To do that, the source material brings in a fascinating concept from Stephen Batchelor.
Who is that?
He's a writer who translates ancient Buddhist concepts into secular dharma, meaning he frames these ideas for a modern non-religious audience.
Okay, got it.
Batchelor describes this practice of skillful intention as imagination.
Imagination. I hear the word imagination and I immediately picture, like, daydreaming or making up fairy tales. How does fantasy help me stop a habit loop?
Well, he doesn't mean fantasy. He defines imagination as an ethically guided creativity.
Ethically guided creativity.
Yes. When we are caught in a compulsion, Batchelor says we suffer from a poverty of imagination.
A poverty of imagination. That is such a striking phrase.
Isn't it? The habit is so deeply ingrained that the mind literally cannot envisage any other response.
So the mental script just says, like, I feel stressed, therefore I must engage in this specific behavior.
Exactly. There are no other realities available. Opening up that imagination is what cures the poverty. It creates a tiny fraction of a second between the stimulus and the response, giving you the creative space to picture a different action.
An action shaped by abandoning, goodwill, or harmlessness.
You got it.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I know a lot of this sounds highly philosophical, but what is actually happening in our biology when we create this imagination space? There has to be a physical mechanism in the brain that makes this work.
There is. And it's essentially a structural race between two different parts of your brain.
A race.
Yeah. Compulsive behaviors and fast habit loops are driven by the basal ganglia.
Okay, the basal ganglia.
That is an older, primitive part of the brain that runs entirely on autopilot. And it is incredibly fast.
So it fires before you're even consciously aware you're doing something.
Yes, exactly. Now, on the other hand, conscious intention relies on your prefrontal cortex.
Right, the front part of the brain.
That's the brain's executive center right behind your forehead. It handles long-term planning, moral reasoning, and impulse inhibition.
But I'm guessing there's a catch.
There is. The problem is the prefrontal cortex is slower to act than the basal ganglia.
Uh-huh. So the autopilot beats the manual override every single time.
Every time. Unless you give the manual override a head start by deliberately pausing to use that imagination, by actively picturing a choice rooted in goodwill or abandoning, you are warming up the prefrontal cortex.
You're bringing it online.
Yes. You are bringing your choice system online early so it can actually outpace the basal ganglia.
This is exactly why elite athletes use mental rehearsal.
Yes, perfect example.
You watch an Olympic skier at the starting gate with their eyes closed, physically swaying as they visualize every single turn on the course. They are priming their nervous system before they ever hit the snow.
Exactly. And the RAF program is saying we can use that exact same psychological mechanism for our own emotional regulation.
That is so cool.
And the field of psychology totally backs this up, particularly acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT.
Right, ACT.
ACT emphasizes that this type of mental rehearsal only truly works if it's anchored in deep personal values. Mm. You aren't just telling your brain, don't do the bad thing.
Because that never works anyway.
Right. You are visualizing a direction that genuinely matters to you, like dignity, connection, or freedom. That emotional weight is what makes the intention credible to your nervous system.
So we have the mechanism. We need to prime the prefrontal cortex. But how do we practically execute that when the pressure is on? I mean, we can't just tell people to try harder to imagine things.
No, that wouldn't help anyone. The most effective strategy is utilizing what psychologists call implementation intentions.
Implementation intentions. What's that?
Essentially, it is an if-then player. You set your course before the weather turns because you do not want to be making complex ethical calculations while you're in the middle of a panic attack or a craving.
Oh, totally. So you preload the decision.
Exactly.
Like, if my boss sends an abrasive email at 4 p.m., then I will step away from the keyboard for 2 minutes.
Yes. You've pre-linked the trigger to a skillful response.
Okay. The RAF program actually outlines a 7-step sequence to do this in real time. Let's trace a really common scenario through this sequence to see how the mechanics actually work.
Sounds good.
Let's say it's late at night. You feel this dull ache of loneliness, and you feel the undeniable pull to mindlessly scroll social media for 2 hours, which you know will just make you feel worse.
Yep.
Step one is simply name the pull.
Right. You call it out quietly to yourself, grasping is here, or the urge to escape is tempting.
What does naming it actually do?
The psychological mechanism here is that naming an emotion moves it from the emotional center of the brain to the language and logic center.
Oh, so it shifts the brain activity.
Yes. It stops being a foggy, overwhelming feeling and becomes an object you can actually examine.
Then we move to step two. Call the tone and soften the body.
Mm-hmm.
You notice if the feeling underneath the pull is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then, crucially, you take 3 soft out-breaths. Now, I have to push back on this.
Okay, go for it.
Taking deep breaths when I'm relaxed is fine. But if I'm caught in a compulsion, or let's say I'm furious, pausing to take 3 soft breaths feels incredibly unnatural. It might even make me more irritated. How do you force a tense body to just soften?
You're right. It feels totally unnatural at first, because when a compulsion hits, your nervous system triggers a threat response.
Right, fight or flight.
Exactly. Your body physically braces for impact, your jaw clenches, your shoulders hike up. That physical tension sends a signal back to the brain that says, we're in danger, act now.
And breathing changes that.
Yes. By forcing those three soft out breaths, you are short-circuiting that physical feedback loop. You are mechanically signaling safety to the nervous system, which debraces the body. It isn't about feeling zen.
Oh, it's physiological.
It's about physically unlocking the brain's ability to choose.
Wow, so you're literally using the body to hack the brain. Okay, so once the tension is broken, we hit step three. Choose the intention. This is where we bring in our three directions. For the late night phone scrolling, maybe you choose abandoning. You lean into letting go and simplifying.
Which brings us to step four. Set a cue. You need to give yourself a short phrase to hold that course. Something like let go or keep it simple.
Why does it have to be so short?
Because a brain under stress has very little working memory. If your cue is a long, complex paragraph about your personal growth goals, you simply won't remember it.
That makes sense.
It needs to be a two or three word anchor to tether your attention.
Keep it simple. Got it. Step five is preview it. This is bachelor's imagination in action, right?
Yes, exactly. Before you even move a muscle, you rehearse the wiser option in your mind for just one single second.
So you vividly picture yourself putting the phone on the charger and walking into the kitchen for a glass of water.
Right. Because the mind tends to execute whatever physical action it has most recently and vividly pictured.
And that primes you for step six. Take one small step. Just one single concrete action that aligns with your intention.
Right. You don't have to resolve your entire feeling of loneliness tonight. Just physically put the phone down. One small physical movement breaks the paralysis of the habit loop.
And finally, step seven, close the loop. This is critical. You take a split second to consciously register the victory. You tell yourself, I noticed the pull, I made a choice, and I steered.
That recording phase is so important.
Why is that?
You are actively recording the event so your brain learns that it can successfully resist an urge.
That builds confidence.
Yeah.
But this raises an important reality check, though. We do not live in a textbook.
No, we definitely don't.
Sometimes the rudder slips. Sometimes you try to set your intention, but the thought just gets sticky. It loops and loops in your head, and the current just takes you anyway. What happens then?
The text is incredibly compassionate about this reality. Skillful intention is not about flawless execution. It's about the willingness to return.
The willingness to return. I love that.
But when you do encounter a thought that simply refuses to leave, the program does offer a few distinct mechanisms to unstick it.
Okay, let's look at the mechanics of how to pry a sticky thought loose, because you don't just have to sit there and suffer through it. The first option is substitution.
Right.
If a thought is relentlessly negative, you don't fight it. You actively replace it with a thought that is steadier or kinder. You crowd the bad thought out.
And if that doesn't work, a second mechanism is to reflect on the downside. You play the tape forward.
Like asking yourself where this leads.
Exactly. You ask yourself, if I keep feeding this resentment or this craving, what will my life look like in an hour, in a year? Exposing the painful destination can drain the thought of its immediate appeal.
Oh, that's powerful. A third way is withdrawing attention. You don't fight the thought, but you refuse to give it any more airtime.
How do you do that practically?
You forcefully shift your focus to the raw physical sensation of your feet on the floor or the texture of the steering wheel in your hands. You just starve the mental loop of its attention fuel.
That's a great grounding technique. You can also tackle it physiologically by softening the tension. Like we discussed earlier, looping thoughts require physical tension to sustain themselves.
Oh, right.
So if you scan your body and deliberately relax a clenched jaw or a tight stomach, the mental loop often loses its structural support and just collapses.
And if absolutely all else fails, you contain it. You set a hard boundary. You mentally say, not now, and immediately pivot to a task.
Right. You just box it up for the moment.
You treat the thought like bad weather outside your window.
Yeah.
It's happening. But you don't have to go out and stand in it.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean when we put the pieces together?
It means that skillful intention is the vital bridge between knowing what is good for you and actually doing it. It's the shift from being a passive victim of your impulses to being an active participant in your own freedom.
Before we wrap up, we want to make sure you know exactly where this phenomenal framework comes from. The RAFT program, specifically the RAFT to Freedom workbook, is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And they are doing something incredible.
They really are. They are making the entire 66-chapter program freely available online. You can access all of it by visiting your website at raft2freedom.org. It is an absolute goldmine of a resource.
It really is. And as we leave you today, let's just step back and look at the bigger picture.
Yeah.
We live in a society that is increasingly built to hijack our basal ganglia. Every app, every outrage-driven headline, every targeted ad, they're all designed to keep us on autopilot, reacting endlessly to the next stimulus.
It's exhausting.
It is. So choosing to pause, to utilize your prefrontal cortex, to deploy imagination, that isn't just a self-help trick. It is a quiet act of rebellion against a world that wants you to run on impulse.
To reclaim your agency is to rebel against the autopilot. That is a profound way to look at it.
With that in mind, we want to leave you with a self-reflection prompt drawn directly from the text, something to experiment with in the wild today.
What's the prompt?
Ask yourself, when you are under pressure today, what direction does your mind naturally pull toward letting go, getting angry, or trying to control?
Pay attention to those deep ruts your mind naturally wants to follow. Remember that you have the tools to carve a new path. We'll close today's deep dive with a final thought from Christina Feldman, quoted right at the end of the chapter. We learn to apply and reapply, moment to moment, with an effort that is calm and caring. Keep your hands on the wheel. We'll see you next time.